This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. During this hour, we present an archive interview of a show that aired earlier. Since it is an archive, we can't take your calls during this hour. I think most of us by now know that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has, in its history, engaged in some pretty horrifying and violent projects. The world can be a dangerous place, and it seems reasonable to have an intelligence agency well-equipped to defend our nation's security and democratic values. However, when our security agencies engage in acts that undermine those values, it can and has led to disaster. So the question of torture committed by the United States and its allies in the War on Terror has special relevance. Have Americans engaged in such acts? Based on the photographic and other evidence from Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, the answer is clearly yes. Who was ultimately responsible? The answer to that, and other questions about so-called rendering of suspected terrorists to foreign torturers and allegations of secret prisons run by the U.S., remain contested. What isn't contested is that the question of interrogation and torture has occupied U.S. security agencies since before the Cold War. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who has studied that history in great depth. Alfred W. McCoy is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of several books, including a study of the global drug trade entitled The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, and a study of the impact of CIA torture on the Philippine military entitled Closer Than Brothers. During the next hour, we'll talk with Professor McCoy about his latest book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, just published by Metropolitan Books. And Alfred McCoy joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Morning, Jack.
Thanks so much for being here.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
You begin the book with a story about your mother in pre-World War II Germany, getting a glimpse of the horrors perpetrated through the ages in places like Nuremberg. It seems that in recent centuries, torture has been pretty common.
Yes, but there's a real difference in the way the United States has practiced torture. Sadly, there is, in fact, a distinctive form of a torture that is very problematic, extraordinarily persistent, and distinctively American. That's psychological torture. That's the form that we've used for the last 50 years and that we're using with variations today.
We'll certainly talk about that in detail. The images, for example, from Abu Ghraib certainly shocked the world and they shocked Americans. We like to believe we are above such things as torturing prisoners, even those who commit acts of terrorism. And the U.S. was a key proponent of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Geneva Convention, and other international agreements banning inhumane treatment. It's not like we have our history does have some bright moments in terms of our advocacy for human rights.
Oh, indeed. Look, throughout the Cold War, for 40 years, from the late 1940s through the early 1990s, the United States lived with what I call a comfortable contradiction. On the one hand, we were indeed not just an advocate, but the world's leading advocate of human rights. We played a key role in the drafting of the Geneva Conventions. Indeed, we reserved the right to execute those who violate the conventions. We took a position tougher than the rest of the world. Our former First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, played a seminal role in the drafting of the UN Convention, the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And throughout the last 50 years, we've been world leaders. Simultaneously, however, while the U.S. government was advocating human rights publicly, privately, secretly, the CIA, at the dawn of the Cold War, was investigating torture, was developing new sophisticated techniques of torture, and then propagating them worldwide. And this contradiction is one we've lived with right up until the present. Indeed, at the start of the War on Terror, President Bush kind of continued this policy when he gave secret orders for torture that his aides then rendered lawful through a very complex legal memoranda. These orders went to the intelligence community. They percolated down through the military. But then when Abu Ghraib happened and those photos revealed these torture techniques in shocking living color, the United States was at a crossroads. At that point, the secret was out. And we had a choice as a nation. We could either prohibit torture fully and join the international community in that prohibition, or we could persist in the practice. And under the Bush administration, we are now persisting in the practice. It is becoming, if you will, U.S. policy to reject the findings of the International Red Cross, to break with the UN Anti-Torture Convention, and insist that torture is a presidential prerogative in the defense of America.
Now, we'll get back to the present-day circumstances and talk more about that. I want to step back a bit and talk about the origins of the CIA's involvement in studying interrogation methods and developing new techniques. And this is at the start of the Cold War?
Yes, indeed. At the start of the Cold War, in the late 1940s, the Soviets conducted a series of show trials across Eastern Europe, and particularly the trial of Joseph Cardinal Mindszenty in Hungary led the CIA and the leaders in Washington to believe that the Soviets had somehow cracked the code of human consciousness, that their experiments in human psychology had given them ways of programming people. At that point, the ignorance about the human mind, about cognitive science, was extreme. Our knowledge was rudimentary. And so what our Cold Warriors were faced with was this void of knowledge, not knowing what secrets, what mysteries the Soviets might have solved, what weapons they might have. And indeed, this was a war for ideas. At a public level, mass propaganda, communism versus democracy. At a private level, agents and double agents, people programmed and deprogrammed. And so when the Soviets seemed to have some kind of lock, some kind of knowledge that we didn't have, this set off panic bells, and the CIA led a crash program, a kind of Manhattan Project of the Mind, which at peak had funding of $1 billion a year to crack the code of human consciousness and come up with a new form of interrogation.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Most Americans have kind of fragments of memory about this era. We all know about the CIA's experiments with LSD back in the 1950s. And most people are aware that there was a former CIA employee who was given an unwitting dose of LSD and was either jumped or was pushed from his hotel room in New York City, Dr. Frank Olson. President Ford apologized to the widow and the children of Dr. Olson in the 1970s. but what most people don't realize is that all of those lurid drug experiments, sensational though they are, well documented by U.S. Congress and lots of books and articles, they didn't matter in the end. This was a road not taken. When you conduct biomedical research, what most labs find on most days is negative results. They don't usually report them. They're not good for funding, but that's what you generally get. Okay, and so all that drug research showed that LSD didn't work, hypnosis didn't work, truth serum didn't work, electroshock didn't work. None of these exotic techniques worked. What did work was mundane behavioral science research done by psychology, primarily and secondarily by psychiatry departments at some of the leading universities in the United States, all done in a routine way with student volunteers, all dutifully and dully reported, albeit sanitized, in scientific journals. And this led to the breakthroughs that produced psychological torture.
Who did this research, and who were the subjects of these experiments that the CIA funded?
There were hundreds of experiments, millions of dollars. In fact, because of the funding came from the CIA, and the CIA then would contract other government agencies, for example, like the Office of Naval Research. So they'd have a contract that CIA would give funds to Office of Naval Research. Office of Naval Research, in turn, would give contracts to institutions, either federal or universities. They would then hire researchers. So there were, effectively, there were three cutouts between the actual researcher and the CIA. And in many cases, the researcher had no idea who he was working for and what the purpose of the work was. There were literally hundreds of projects, but three of them produced the main results. The first was a discovery of sensory disorientation by one of the most brilliant psychologists of his generation, a man who was, in fact, recognized as one of the 100 greatest psychologists in the United States by the American Psychological Association of the 20th century, Dr. Donald O'Hebb at the McGill University. Dr. Hebb found that he could induce a state akin to psychosis in just 48 hours. Now, what did he do? Drugs? Electrical shock? Hypnosis? None of the above. All he did was he had student volunteers from McGill sit in a nice air-conditioned cubicle, they were deprived of senses by goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. First, they went through hallucinations, and then many of them within 48 hours would suffer a breakdown akin to acute psychosis. This became the foundation for sensory disorientation. Next, two eminent neurologists at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City did a study of KGB torture techniques for the CIA, and they discovered that the KGB's most effective technique was not brutal physical beating, but was simply ordering the subject to stand motionless for 2 or 3 days. As the fluids drained to the legs swelled, separating sores erupted, the kidneys shut down, hallucinations developed. That they put these two techniques together, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, and that was the foundation of the CIA's paradigm. There was a third experiment. Now that the CIA had its technique worked out, as it prepared to propagate or disseminate this technique worldwide, it needed to know who would torture, who could be trained to torture. At that point, there was a kind of authoritarian personality thesis that you had to be kind of like a Gestapo-like personality. There was only a certain kind of mindset, a certain kind of human being that would do this dirty work. There was a very famous experiment by Dr. Stanley Milgram at Yale University called the Yale Obedience Experiments. And he found that any ordinary citizen in New Haven who answered an ad in the local paper, the New Haven Register, and came in and earned $4.50 for participating in an experiment could take orders from a man in a white coat and raise electrical shocks all the way to a fatal level. In short, anybody could torture. So this was the CIA's foundational technique. They codified it in a manual called the Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual in 1963. And for the next 30 years, they disseminated these results worldwide and throughout the U.S. intelligence community. Now, when those Abu Ghraib photographs were released, and we all looked at those shocking pictures, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said this was the work just a few soldiers. William Sapphire, columnist writing the New York Times, called the 7 military police allegedly responsible solely for these acts, called them creeps. They were later called recycled hillbillies from Cumberland, Maryland. I looked at those photos, particularly that most famous, iconic photo, which is on the cover of my book, of the Iraqi standing on a box, hooded, arms extended with fake electrical wires hanging from his arms. What I saw was not creeps, not individual sadism. I saw the CIA's signature techniques. The Iraqi was hooded for sensory disorientation. His arms were extended, and he was standing for self-inflicted pain. These are the agency's trademark techniques. These are not the kind of sophisticated psychological techniques that a prison guard and a pizza delivery specialist learn in ordinary civilian life or in their military duties. These techniques percolated. They disseminated from the CIA, and they're a result of orders that come from the top.
Now I want to sort of go back a bit over this ground, because you say that as a result of these experiments, they developed techniques that they considered breakthroughs, basically, in interrogating people.
Yeah, because for 2,000 years, torture had been used formally by states in judicial interrogations. In the Roman Empire, it was required that a slave that appeared before court had to be tortured, otherwise his testimony or her testimony was deemed invalid. From the 12th century onward, Europe reintroduced Roman law, and with it, this concern for evidence, which required judicial torture. Moreover, the Roman Catholic Church, during the Inquisition, used torture to extract evidence. So whether in civil or canonical courts in Europe, for over 500 years, torture was mandated. So we have a very long experience of torture. And what we found in the 2,000 years that the Western world has been engaged in torture is exactly what the Roman jurist Ulpian wrote in the 3rd century A.D. based on his experience of the Roman use of torture. Ulpian said in his legal commentaries, torture is a dangerous thing. The strong will resist and the weak will say anything to end the pain. And that was the problem with all coerced interrogation, okay? Very simply, if you beat on somebody and they are committed, they're not innocent, they're committed, they're a hardened criminal, they're a revolutionary, they're a trained spy, whatever, that as you beat on them, their anger towards you grows. They become less cooperative, more hostile, and they will fight you. The strong will resist, as Ulpian said. The idea of the CIA method was that instead of beating on the person, it's self-inflicted pain. They simply stand there, and the interrogator says, "You're doing this to yourself. As soon as you cooperate, this will end, but you're doing this to yourself." so that they can't transfer their anger outward. They internalize it. And the combination, and this is the art of it, as such as it might be, is to blend the two basic techniques, very elaborate forms of sensory disorientation, with very skillful forms of self-inflicted pain, and thus to break the person down in a way that makes them genuinely cooperative. The problem is, of course, is that psychological torture does not, in fact, defeat Olpian's dictum. The strong do resist, and the weak will, in fact, say anything to end the pain.
Now, this is all codified in a thing that you mentioned, the Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Handbook.
If anybody doesn't believe me, if you want to do is go into Google and type Kubark, okay, and you will have a PDF on your computer screen of the manual, the original TypeScript copy, okay? It'll pop right up. You can read it for yourself.
And it's spelled K-U-B-A-R-K.
Right, Kubark, right. That's it. All you have to do is this. What Kubark is, you know, in my research, that's one of those mysteries. I don't know. I call it curiously titled, but it's distinctive. It's the only Kubark out there. You'll get it right away, and you can read it too. But the main thing to do is not only read the lessons, but also read the footnotes, because the footnotes reveal, if you will, the academic genealogy of the torture research. It reveals the experiments, the hundreds of experiments that the CIA sponsored indirectly through other federal agencies that led to this research, that led to this discovery.
We have a caller to talk with. I want to include them. Let me also reintroduce our guest during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Alfred McCoy. He's professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're discussing his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, just published by Metropolitan Books. We do have one listener waiting. We'll welcome others if you want to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with the Champaign listener, line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I think we need to understand in this community that, in fact, torture has affected us here at the University of Illinois in Champaign. Several years ago, the chairman of the psychology department at that time, Emmanuel Donchin, had a contract with the Central Intelligence Agency to develop a better lie detector test for the CIA. Not only did he have the contract, but he used his own students over there as guinea pigs to develop this better lie detector test for the CIA. In addition, Professor Donchin had worked for Technion, which is an institute over in Israel that works very closely with the Mossad. And we all know that the Mossad and Shin Bet over there in Israel torture people. So here we have on our own faculty a torture professor. Thank you.
Okay.
I can't comment on the particulars. I don't know the case, and it would be irresponsible of me to do so. But what I can say is simply this, is that as I argue in my book, A Question of Torture, that when you try and assess responsibility for the development of this distinctive American paradigm, it's there's enough blame to go all the way around. One could ascribe responsibility, for example, to the bipartisan administrations that sponsored these techniques. The CIA did this work for 40 years under Democrats and Republicans alike. Or one could then assign responsibility to the great universities, and they are our greatest, that hosted this research, to the eminent scientists, and it's the most brilliant of behavioral scientists that made these breakthroughs. And then ultimately, when the press investigated and Congress exposed, the American people, for the most part, remained silent, and thus, in the context of a democracy, essentially complicit. So we're all implicated in this. And if you scratch the surface, the better the university, the more likely it is that you'd have a contract, one of these contracts. Indeed, for example, when sensory disorientation was discovered at McGill University by Donald Hebb, and he is one of the greatest behavioral scientists of his generation, part of the brain is named after Hebb because of his incredibly important contributions to cognitive science. Donald Hebb didn't really know what the source of the funds were and the ultimate aim of the research. His findings were later tested by government contracts at Harvard, Princeton, Yale. British intelligence, which was collaborating with the CIA, farmed out the research to a mental hospital in the UK. In effect, this is one of those examples of the cost of having a covert agency in a society. Civil institutions and their standards are compromised. The CIA operates, if you will, kind of like an espionage agency in its own society, penetrating hospitals, the U.S. military, USAID, universities, distinguished careers to develop and propagate these techniques.
I want to follow up on that point, but I also want to state for the record that I have no idea of the factual basis of the claim made by the previous caller. Since it was quite a claim and certainly very strongly made, I want to make sure that listeners know that it was a claim by the caller, and I don't know the veracity of it, so I want to state that for the record.
Jack, I have to state as well. I have no idea whether it's accurate or not, but all I can say is apropos of that comment, that one will find similar sorts of research, assuming that that's an accurate description, at every major university in the United States that has a well-developed psychology department. Indeed, there's a larger problem out here. There's a debate, in fact, right now in the American Psychological Association over the relationship between the careers of psychology, the role of psychologists in the whole the conduct of interrogation right now in Guantanamo. Indeed, the American psychology profession, fragments of it, but as an organization and some of its eminent leaders, has a long, if episodic, history of alliance with the CIA in the development and the perfection of this paradigm. when Secretary Rumsfeld decided to turn Guantanamo into an aggressive interrogation center, he appointed a man named General Jeffrey Miller to head Guantanamo. And Jeffrey Miller's innovation in 2002 was to create what he called behavioral science consultation teams. And he had military psychologists, who were professionally trained psychologists with degrees and credentials. He integrated them into the actual process of interrogation, reading the patient's medical files, observing the interrogation, and trying to find individual phobias. Moreover, at Guantanamo as well, they experimented with cultural techniques, probing Arab male sensitivity to gender and sexuality. The net result has been that psychologists developed the essentials of this technique back in the 1950s. And that was an assault, if you will, on universal human receptors, sensory receptors, sight and sounds, smell, sense of time, and the like. Then, under the War on Terror, the CIA's psychological paradigm has been virtually perfected at Guantanamo by moving, first of all, to attack on cultural sensibilities and then adding to that probing of individual phobias. So now the CIA's paradigm has a kind of three-phase total assault on the human psychology, sensory receptors, cultural identity, and individual phobias and psyche. And there's a... The last summer, the American Psychological Association became very much concerned about the ethics of having its members participating not in the treatment and the helping of patients, but but in actual breaking them down for purposes of interrogation. And they constituted an ethics committee, which was unfortunately dominated by military psychologists who were actually the objects of the inquiry. The net result was a very compromised ethics report. One of the problems that there are two professions in the United States, indeed anywhere in the world, that have both knowledge and power about the human mind. One is psychiatry, and they are medical doctors, and they take the Hippocratic Oath, so they have been restrained in their alliance with the CIA and the military in the development of these techniques. Psychology has the same knowledge and power, but they don't take the Hippocratic Oath. They are not ethically or morally restrained, and they have proved thus much more effective long-term allies of the CIA in this process.
We're a little past our midpoint here. Let me just mention again, we're talking during this hour of Focus 580 with Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and just recently published by Metropolitan Books. Our lines are full, so I want to go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Oh, yeah, hi. This is a really fascinating subject. I've noticed recently, and I read neurobiology journals, and I've noticed that there's a lot of research into ways to detect lying through passive means, you know, functional MRIs and things like that. And I'm wondering if that's tied into some sort of interrogation techniques or maybe paid for by the CIA or other whatever. I wouldn't see why other maybe police, you know, police systems or, you know, criminologists. But also wanted to ask you something else. How much of your book or your knowledge is about the use of pharmaceuticals like hallucinogens in these interrogations, you know, where you would maybe just completely bend someone's mind chemically and then hopefully bring them back? Do you know anything about that?
Sure. That was the at the start of the CIA's massive mind control project in the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. They thought that the real results would come from a combination of electroshock, truth serum, cytopenethol, and then later as LSD. And they invested an enormous amount of effort. Most of the CIA's own in-house research was focused on this, and that's why the CIA engaged in all these kinds of outlandish activity. For example, they had kind of two party houses, one in New York and one in San Francisco. And in the San Francisco one, they had a retinue of prostitutes whose job it was to go out and pick up customers off the street, bring them back, slip them an LSD cocktail, and then in front of a CIA camera behind a two-way mirror, the CIA would document the breakdown. It was an intensive effort, and by the end, by the early 1960s, and certainly by 1972, 73, when the CIA wound up and stopped this research, they generally concluded that this was an illusion. Now, there's one part of this research we don't know about. We know pretty much about the activities by the CIA, some of their internal research, what went on in those party houses, because that was investigated by Congress in the mid-1970s. What we don't know about is there was apparently, as a result of this collaboration between British intelligence and the CIA, there was a joint black site near Frankfurt in Germany where the CIA and British intelligence did extreme experiments fatal experiments on people deemed expendables, suspected double agents, captured spies, and the like, that they could literally torture to death with these techniques. We don't know what the findings were. I've never seen any results from that. But back to your original point, the way we can tell now, in all likelihood, that an experiment was done through the influence of the CIA is by trying to track the trail of the contracts. For example, millions of American high school students have seen that video about the Yale obedience experiments, the man in the white coat with the electric shock dial, the actor as the dial ratchets up to greater and greater supposed electric shock. There's no shock at all, of course. He starts grunting, then he screams, then ultimately he dies. And we watch as the man in the white coat orders the ordinary citizen to raise the degree of shock to the point where the pain becomes death. Okay, and but nobody knew, what was that for? Why did suddenly the National Science Foundation, promoting science for the benefit of mankind, need to know who would torture and who wouldn't torture? When you track the trail of that research, what you find out is that Milgram initially made his application to the Office of Naval Research, which was the primary agency serving as a blind for CIA behavioral work. Milgram was denied tenure at Harvard because of reservations about his ethics. He was ultimately hired by City University of New York, and he was hired at an advanced status because the dean of the graduate school was a woman named Mina Reese, who had recently retired as deputy director of Office of Naval Research. In other words, ONR had this very protective relationship with Milgram. So when you see that trail of academic articles on a certain kind of topic dealing with aspects of human behavior, like the kind you found, one has reasons to be suspicious. Indeed, now we can look back and we can see that all of those hundreds of articles in reputable journals about sensory disorientation
that appeared after Hebb's discovery became so enticing for the CIA. CIA decided this was important by 1954. By 1961, there were something like 250 articles in leading scientific journals dealing with sensory disorientation. Most of that research you can track back to the agency and its attempt to perfect torture. Now we have a problem with interrogation again in the war on terror, and it's not surprising you're going to see that kind of surge of academic research on veracity of subjects in interrogation.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your work.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have several callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener on a cell phone, line number 4. Good morning. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. We in the advanced country, America and Europe, like, we have many, many times stated the fact that we are opposed to torture as a means of interrogation, as a means of justice. We have been very vocal about third world countries that practice it. But on the other hand, we actually promote this indirectly because we get involved in it. So where is this double standard leading us? Is it helping to promote peace and democracy, or is it helping to destroy peace and democracy? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Very good question. I think the caller raises an excellent point. What are the implications for the United States as a leader, a moral leader of the international community, if we propagate torture? Look, until the Abu Ghraib scandal came out in 2004, roughly for 40 or 50 years, the United States had this comfortable contradiction. On the one hand, publicly, we advocated international standards of human rights. Simultaneously and secretly, the CIA was allowed to engage in torture research, indeed propagation of torture techniques to allied nations around the world. That contradiction came to an end in 2004. And now we're faced with a real question. I would argue that it would be very difficult for us to be the moral leader of the international community, both for the war on terror and indeed for other larger aims beyond that war, if we engage in torture. More than any other single act by a modern state, torture delegitimates the state. It has an enormous moral stigma. There's nothing like it. Now that slavery is abolished, we're working to eliminate genocide. Torture remains as the one act by a state that can stigmatize it. And it's torture it doesn't have to be many. A torture of one individual or a very few individuals delegitimates a state. So we're faced with a very real contradiction. The damage to America's moral leadership, both in the war on terror and as the world's preeminent power, has been enormous as a result of the Abu Ghraib scandal. And right now, for example, the Council of Europe is investigating CIA and U.S. use of torture. They have an ongoing investigation because Europe has taken a very strong position on this. This will damage our leadership. And yet, even so, the Bush administration is determined to torture. They have fought Senator John McCain over his attempt to prohibit torture, and the White House has effectively compromised the McCain Amendment banning torture, twisting it to the point where it will now serve to legitimate, if not legalize, torture in the United States. Well, we can't take that position and preserve our moral leadership.
Several callers remain waiting. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. At the risk of promoting torture, I wanted to pin down exactly what it was that these people are gaining by torturing. You said that sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain were most effective, but to do what exactly? To break them down and then get false information, or to get them to talk freely without reference to whether they're being truthful or not?
Right. The idea is that this is the theory, not the practice, and I try to be clear about that. The theory is that by engaging in physical brutality towards a subject, you increase the subject's anger towards the interrogator, and you get less cooperation, okay? In theory, then, by self-inflicted pain and sensory disorientation, you scramble the person's consciousness, break down their reserves, their resistance, by playing with their sense of time, by disorienting subjecting them to dark or bright light. In other words, you use the sensory receptors to break them down.
You use self-inflicted pain to have them internalize their own suffering and blame themselves. The idea is then that as they blame themselves, and then in the extreme isolation of sensory disorientation, in their confusion, they reach out, they need human contact, and they will bond with the interrogator. Okay? That's the theory. The theory is then that they will not only give you information, but they will, because of the bonding with the interrogator, the information will be accurate. Generally, however, the psychological torture produces the same reaction as the more conventional physical variant. The strong resist and the weak say anything to end the pain. So it doesn't work. But there are, in the United States, other tried and true techniques. Those who advocate torture, pro-pain pundits and professors across the country have been very verbal and very vocal on this point. They tell us that we basically have a choice in the war on terror between tortured information and no information at all. In other words, the debate has been structured so that if we don't torture, we're stripping ourselves of the knowledge we need to defend this country. But there are alternatives, okay? During World War II, there was a Marine Corps major who had been a missionary, a Christian missionary in Japan before the war, and was fluent in Japanese. Moreover, he was a humanist. And so when he was given captured Japanese soldiers in the Pacific Island campaign, he established empathy. So impressed were the Marine Corps with his findings that they built a corps of Japanese-trained interrogators. And the Marine Corps found that these interrogators, by establishing empathy, could extract from Japanese soldiers accurate and complete order of battle intelligence within 24 hours of landing on Saipan and Tinian in the Pacific Island hopping campaign. And they got this information voluntarily from Japanese soldiers who were supposed to be fanatics, indoctrinated in a belief in the divinity of the emperor. Okay, not easy subjects. The FBI still uses this same technique. Back in the 1990s, when we had the bombings, the terror bombings against our embassies in East Africa, the FBI was in charge of the investigation. They go by the book. They establish empathy with the detainees. They got accurate information. They brought them into U.S. courts of law. These men confessed. They're now in federal prison. Moreover, we got very good information from them at the time. So the point is that there is another American doctrine, okay, of empathetic interrogation that's fully within the law. And if you look at the record, okay, right now there are hundreds of U.S. Army soldiers on trial in military courts for abuse, many of them convicted, all, of course, below the rank of sergeant, but that's another story. Second, there's about four or five cases against the CIA for brutal interrogation, and there should be more. There are no cases against the FBI because they've gone by the book. They've been quite effective. But unfortunately, at the start of the war on terror, the FBI was the lead agency. The Bush administration wanted to torture, so they stripped the FBI of their primary control of the al-Qaeda captives, turned them over to the CIA for torture. The result has been terrible. Okay, for example, CIA got a hold of this. They took away the first top al-Qaeda captive, a man named al-Libi, who had been running a training camp for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. CIA got control of him. They rendered him to Egypt. They tortured him for 2 weeks. They waterboarded him. They put him through the whole CIA repertoire of torture. And he confessed that al-Qaeda had received training in chemical and biological weapons from Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell took al-Libi's intelligence, went before the United Nations in February 2003, and told the world that we had accurate, verified intelligence that Saddam Hussein had trained al-Qaeda in chemical and biological weapons. Well, of course, ex-Secretary of State Powell, is enormously embarrassed by that false statement, as is the United States. And indeed, a year later, in early 2004, the CIA issued a formal finding that al-Libi was a fabricator, and they withdrew all intelligence based on his statements. In other words, you get bad information from coercive interrogation, whether psychological, physical, or a combination thereof. And there are alternatives. We don't have to do this to be effective.
Sounds as if you're saying that if put in front of Congress, for example, you could document that these alternative methods were actually more effective.
You could bring up retired career FBI counterintelligence, counterterror operatives, okay, who spent 20 years doing this work, and they would tell you, as they've told the media, and I quote them in my book, about their techniques, about their experience, and their revulsion, their horror at the kinds of things that the CIA is doing. I mean, these are career FBI, law enforcement, counterintelligence specialists who've given their life over to fighting terrorists and securing this country, and they are outraged at what the CIA has been doing. It's not necessary, but that's part of the little-understood perverse psychopathology of torture that I try and explain in my book, is that torture appeals to those dark recesses of our consciousness where procreation and destruction, life and death, infinite capacity for cruelty and infinite capacity for kindness all coexist in human consciousness. And those who use torture become drawn into an utter fascination with it, convinced beyond all information, beyond all rationality, that it's effective. They also ignore the cost, the political cost, and the consequences of engaging in torture. So those that do it, I think the powerful order, largely in times of crisis, because it assages their sense of insecurity and gives them a sense of power and control.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like it's quite similar to wife abuse.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. We have some callers waiting, and I'll get on to them. We just have about 10 minutes left with our guest, Alfred McCoy, discussing his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, published by Metropolitan Books. I did want to ask one question here, if I could interject, and I will defer to the callers after this. It seems that the claim has been that the techniques we're using now aren't really torture. It's a kinder, gentler kind of interrogation, so to speak. And I guess the question then would be, you know, what do you think of that claim? Is psychological torture, if that's what we want to call this, is that real torture, or is it something less?
That's an excellent question. There is a generalized belief in this country that psychological torture is not really torture. We have this ultimate American euphemism about it. We call it torture light, and make sure you spell that correctly. And there's this idea of torture light, that psychological torture is not really torture. And why do we believe this? Through those invisible tendrils that tie a state to its society, we have all kinds of cultural productions that reinforce this idea. For over 10 years, NYPD Blue, in 200 episodes with 20 million Americans watching, had scenarios of torture. You know, a detective, Andy Sipowicz, would always get a bad guy, put him in the pokey, the interrogation room, tune him up with a little bit of beating or psychological abuse, and extract information that saved lives and saved the city and made us all safer. And now we've got on Fox Network, we've got 24, and we've got our heroic agent, CIA counterterrorism agent, going around using torture on almost every episode in order to save us from the bad guys. Moreover, there are academics like Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard University who advocate torture as an effective means of extracting information. The biomedical evidence is very clear right now. There are over 100 torture treatment centers around the world. And in the United States, we have the Center for Victims of Torture in Minneapolis. They are the oldest center in the United States. They are approaching 10,000 patients. And what the director of that center, testifying in front of Congress last year, said that based on their enormous experience, that psychological torture is worse than physical torture. It leaves far more lasting damage in the victims than the physical variant. So psychological torture is worse. Moreover, the UN Anti-Torture Convention makes no distinction. The UN Anti-Torture Convention bans both physical and psychological severe pain, okay? But unfortunately, in the United States, when we ratified that convention back in 1994, President Clinton adopted four detailed paragraphs of so-called diplomatic reservation, that's to say we ratify the treaty except, that were drafted by the Reagan administration. And these four very detailed paragraphs of reservation were all focused on just one word in the 26 printed pages of the UN Convention. That word was mental. And if you understand the CIA's psychological torture technique, and you look at those paragraphs of reservation, which, by the way, are also written into U.S. federal law verbatim, what you'll see is we've cleverly crafted a way of exempting the CIA's psychological technique from our interpretation of the UN Convention. In effect, we split the UN treaty down the middle. We banned physical techniques, which we deemed to be torture, and we effectively exempted psychological techniques to protect the CIA's paradigm. So that's why Condoleezza Rice could go to Europe late last year and say, we do not torture with absolute sincerity, and our European allies would greet her words with absolute skepticism, okay? And what we're doing is we're talking about two different things. We've definitionally redefined torture to mean other than psychological torture, to mean basically physical torture.
Okay. We have several callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign County, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. But making someone stand so long, even with or without sensory deprivation, that their kidneys might fail would actually meet the Bybee Yu Gonzalez definition that was withdrawn a while back about major organ failure. I don't think your kidneys are minor organs. So, it seems that that's not even a coherent category, if you will. I'd like to thank you for your earlier book on politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. It was pivotal for so many in our generation. And then I'd like to vouch for Francis Boyle's very well-supported allegation about Donchin and the CIA contracts. That was reported. It became a matter of public record. He defended it by saying that using electroencephalograph brainwave lie detection was going to make it more humane interrogation. So it's a matter of public record that it was done. But he doesn't know how it will be used out in the field. My real motive to call, though, after all that, was you're talking a lot about the CIA's techniques, but the CIA is only one of many. When you say the FBI has actually got this down in some way, but there's also the DIA. There's the military itself. There's the Fort Benning, Georgia School of the Americas. There, the torture manual that was exported during the Reagan era all through Latin America. If the CIA's got it bad, but they're scientific about it, the FBI's got a scientific empathetic interrogation. What about what else is going on? Because I'm convinced that that's not the full story, and I suppose you do treat that some, if you would.
Okay.
Yes, I do treat that in my book. Let me explain. The CIA, right from the beginning, when this project started in the early 1950s, was tasked as the lead agency on this, just as they have been historically the lead U.S. intelligence agency. But they are just one member of the larger U.S. intelligence community. So the work they do and the practices they develop percolate through that. They get disseminated through the entire intelligence community. After the CIA developed its refined torture techniques and codified them in their handbook in 1963, they then worked through two related U.S. government agencies. First, the Office of Public Safety, which was a hybrid CIA-USAID program designed to train police around the Third World. This Office of Public Safety trained something like 1 million police officers in Latin America and Southeast Asia. The CIA used that program as a kind of cover for selecting certain officers for advanced training in torture and interrogation. After Congress found out about Office of Public Safety doing torture training in Brazil, they closed it down, zeroed out its budget. CIA then began working with the U.S. Army from 1975 until roughly 1991 to train interrogators in Latin America, and that's where the School of Americas got involved. Indeed, the U.S. Army actually had a project that was a sort of a sub-project of this larger effort called, and I don't make this up, Project X, and it ran from 1966 to 1991, and its job was to disseminate the lessons learned during the CIA's Phoenix program in South Vietnam to South America. And this involved drafting a complete curriculum with several hundred courses and a three-tier intelligence and counterintelligence program. After the Cold War, when the Defense Department wound up its extraordinary actions that it used during the Cold War, they retracted the 7 training manuals that the U.S. Army intelligence had sent out under Project X. They found that they contained illegal, outrageously illegal techniques involving all kinds of things like torture, destroyed it, and tried to wrap it up. But nonetheless, the techniques persist inside the intelligence community.
The history of U.S. involvement in regimes that, in many cases, we essentially trained to do these techniques, is a very sad one, and there are many examples. And I guess, you know, we're talking about it right now. We're engaging in a conflict in Iraq and a very serious situation right next door in Iran. It seems that there the chickens kind of came home to roost.
Iran is a particularly sad case. After the CIA overthrew the Mossadegh regime in 1953, they installed the Shah. And the Shah was then a rather young and not terribly popular monarch. And in order to put him in power, the CIA helped him build up his secret police apparatus, the notorious SAVAK, train them in torture techniques. And when the opposition to the Shah erupted by Iranian students abroad in Europe and the United States with very visible and vocal demonstrations, they all cited SAVAK's torture. This became the major cause that the anti-Shah demonstrators used in order to stigmatize, discredit the Shah's regime. And ironically, then, CIA torture designed to defend the Shah ultimately destroyed the Shah. And the reason is very simple. More than any other single act by a modern state, torture destroys the moral legitimacy of that state. The same thing was repeated in the Philippines. The CIA trained Marcos's torturers. Ultimately, empowered by their experience of torture, they plotted coups that ultimately overthrew the Marcos regime.
Well, and some might say that, you know, it's perhaps ironic or tragic that those incidents continue to drive events in the current situation.
One of the things that recurs throughout this 50-year American history of torture is that there is never what I would regard a rational calculus in weighing up the costs and benefits.
We're going to have to stop there. That was an archive of an interview that aired originally on February 2nd, 2006, with Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, discussing his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. If you'd like to hear the final 2 minutes of that, the archive is on the website, so go to will.uiuc.edu, where we archive every show that we air on Focus 580.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Karen Retzer in honor of her husband Mike on his birthday this weekend.
Time to hand things off to Jeff Bossert, hosting the Afternoon Magazine.
Thanks, Jack. Coming up this afternoon in the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about computers and you with Peter Kimball, the U of I Computer Assisted Instructor Specialist, and in the 1 o'clock hour. And at 2:40 this afternoon, Chris F.